We are the Halusa Nation.
You need to know they can elevate awareness to a new all-time low.
I own my media.
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 The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members.
But if it's just left out, can you say the paper lied? A lot of things that happened didn't happen after all. If there's no one in the forest who will put it in the news, I guess the tree didn't fall.
Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
I'm joining today. You should too.
Hello, we're back on Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. Sorry about that. I'm here with Lisa.
Yes, we're hi, talking how
about,
are you?
I'm very good, I'm very good. We're talking about the Indigenous Collective at CITR. Tell me a little bit about what you have planned.
Okay, so I just got brought on to CITR as the Indigenous Collective Coordinator, and I am so excited to be working with this community at the station. Basically, what we're going to be doing is we're going to be putting together a one-hour program every Wednesday from 1 until 2 o'clock called Unceded Airwaves. And since it's a collective, we're going to be having all sorts of people from various backgrounds, various nations come on and help to host the show. So it won't always be me hosting. I'm hoping that we'll train up a few other Indigenous broadcasters to get them on the air, hosting interviews, talking about issues, entertainment, you know, anything that is really interesting or pertinent or affects Indigenous lives and community, not only on this campus, but in a broader sense as well. So coming up tomorrow, we actually have our first meeting, which I would like to invite anyone who's interested to come by and get involved with the Indigenous Collective on campus. So our meeting is actually going to be tomorrow at 3:30, and it's going to be right here at CITR in the Nest at UBC. So if you don't have class, make sure you come by. I'm telling people that there will be cookies. I'm hoping that in the future we'll get a bit more food, more of a food budget, but we'll be talking about ways that we can incorporate that into our meetings moving forward. So yeah, if you're interested in making radio, if you're interested in Indigenous issues, if you identify as Indigenous or non-Indigenous, you know, status First Nations, non-status, Métis, Inuit, you know, someone who is just from Indigenous to Turtle Island, you know, we really want to encourage you to come out and participate in the Indigenous Collective this year at CITR.
What are some of the issues that you're looking at on campus right now that are kind of catching your eye?
Well, I don't really want to dictate exactly what the show's going to look like coming up. But what I would like to see happen is I'd really like to see a lot of involvement with the Musqueam Nation, maybe have people from the Musqueam Nation come on to the first show just to start off the whole season in a good way. But I was also thinking about issues, you know, of sovereignty, issues of colonization, what that looks like on campus, how we can, you know, how we can fight colonization in our own subtle ways or not so subtle ways. I'd like to do a lot of cross promotion with various events and lectures that are happening on campus. I know we have a lot of really great Indigenous academics who are coming through, so to be able to tap into that and maybe have people come on the air and do interviews that are very timely and current. I'd also really like to have an arts focus. So, you know, getting different Indigenous artists come on the show. You know, we have a great venue right here at CITR where we can host bands right in our lobby. So Wednesdays from 1 until 2, if your band is available, if you're able to come and perform on Unceded Airwaves, that would be fantastic. Yeah, so anything. It can be anything. It's really what the collective wants to bring forward on the air.
That sounds great. There are some really great academics at UBC talking about these issues. And I know there was the Critical Indigenous Dialogues last week going on.
Yeah, like Leanne Simpson came through. I mean, I would have really liked to have had her come on the show while she was in the area, but Unceded Airwaves hasn't quite hit the air yet. Next week we're going to be on. So next week on Wednesday.
Absolutely.
Our first episode.
Absolutely. There's also this really interesting thing about CITR being a really local station and then being able also to reach out to these more extended, broader kind of audiences and these, you know, broader wells of knowledge to draw on as well. I always think that's a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah, for sure. And I really want to expand the idea of, you know, unceded airwaves to be not only just local, but maybe like, you know, transnational, as in beyond this nation, as in beyond the Musqueam Nation, beyond, you know, anything within the Canadian state. Like, if somehow we could maybe bring someone on to talk about issues, including, you know, the No Dakota Access Pipeline protests that are going on right now, if we could have somebody give their firsthand experience about that, I think that would be really interesting to our listeners as well.
Absolutely. I really look forward to hearing your show.
And I know. I'm really excited.
Yeah. That's going to be great. Thank you so much, Lisa. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Great. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be back. Thanks.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots global unembedded international independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Having trouble finding affordable fresh baked goods and coffee? Come down to Agora Cafe, located in the McMillan building at UBC. There's also space available to study.
Hello, we're back. CITR 101.9. Textbook, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. I'm here now with Elena.
Hey,
Elena,
Josh.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm very good. The middle segment of this show, as I've dictated it, is going to be stories. And sometimes they're going to be very formal. Sometimes they're going to be not so formal. And today, I think it's going to be a mix of the two.
Yeah, maybe not so formal.
Maybe not so formal. There's been a couple stories that people have told me. Okay, there's been more than a couple stories that people have told me. There's been a lot of stories. I hear a lot of good stories all the time from goofballs, always. And I know that a lot of people have this tendency to retell stories. I know I have a tendency
to
do it. And then you get kind of better at the story, or maybe the story starts getting worse. Maybe there's the initial energy that gets
embellished.
Embellished, for sure. Maybe some facts get bent a little bit. That happens. I guess part of it is talking about student stories and their experience maybe on campus, not on campus, because a lot of your life isn't on campus. But I guess that's kind of the point of this middle segment. I don't really know how it's going to go, but we're going to try it in any case.
We're going to find out.
Elena, tell us about yourself. What are you studying?
I am studying English honors at UBC. Right now I'm working for the AMS and I'm living on campus, so a lot of my life is actually on campus right now.
No way. I didn't even know.
For better or for worse.
Like working for the AMS too?
Yeah, volunteering.
Great.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. And you're living at the chateau on campus?
The manor.
The manor, is that what
some
it's called?
Call it, yeah.
Beautiful building, mm-hmm. right at the beginning of campus. You were telling me a story about cannibalism, too, having to do with your courses. We have another guest on later that also used to be in English and
still am
in English, apparently. But there's definitely some weird stuff that happened in classes.
Yeah, especially when you're running on very few hours of sleep and you have to do a presentation in front of all your peers.
Tell us about it.
So about this time last year, I had an enormous paper due right before I had an enormous presentation due. And my paper was about cannibalism as a metaphor for appropriation in South African literature. So I worked so hard on this paper and I'd been thinking about it all day, and finally at maybe 4 a.m. the day before my presentation, I finally finished it. So fell asleep, got a few hours, woke up the next day ready to do my presentation. And it was a pretty big presentation. It was for an honors seminar, so I wanted it to be really good. There was a lot of pressure.
Sure.
And I get into class that day and start giving my presentation on, it was on critical theory, and we were definitely talking about Marx or something, because when it came time for me to give a little spiel about capitalism, I said cannibalism and in the middle of my presentation, and the class just looked at me. No one blinked. And I was like, oh man, like, I promise that I'm not like really sinister and creepy. Like, I've just been thinking a lot about cannibalism recently, which did not help my case. Just a little.
Elena, you were in Amsterdam this year.
Yeah.
Am I right about that?
Uh-huh.
How was that? Tell me about it.
It was a roller coaster. I had a lot of fun, but I also went into it with very rosy glasses on, thinking it would be really a breeze. I thought it would be a lot of fun, and it was difficult. Like, I was away from my friends and family, but overall, a very good time.
Right. You were thinking the exchange would be easy, the process of exchange.
Yeah. I've never left Vancouver before. I've traveled, but I've never lived somewhere else. Like, I've grown up here, gone to UBC. So it was a bigger right. change than I thought it would be.
Right. And you did some traveling while you're in Europe too.
A little bit.
Did that help, or did that?
Maybe a little bit. I didn't do too much traveling, actually. I definitely did not save up enough money to.
Yeah, I feel that.
To go.
I feel that.
I went to Portugal, but nowhere else.
What did you find that was different about the schooling in Amsterdam versus here?
It was definitely not taken as seriously as it is here. I had class a few hours a week, and in the middle of every class, we got a 10-minute smoke break, and classes were an hour long. So I think that speaks for itself.
Right.
Yeah.
just go down by the canal.
Yeah.
Have a cigarette.
Yeah. Mosey back to class. Yeah.
And what was, because I went to Amsterdam when I was maybe 15.
Uh-huh.
I was on the way back from an exchange I was doing in India.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Amsterdam just seeming so gloomy compared to India. And I just had the worst impression of it. And I found the red light district to be just so incredibly sad.
Yeah, mainly the dudes who hang out in the red light district are
right.
Very
I was gonna say the tourists.
Oh man, yeah.
Did you hang out there much? Was there
absolutely
like...
not? I think I went through there twice my whole exchange. Yeah, I actively avoided it for sure.
It's such a weird area, and the consumers there are just very weird. I guess that's it.
Uh huh. Yeah, well, because you ideally do want sex work to be the safest it can be for women, but. When it's so open, you like the very sketchy, creepy dudes are also out in the open, and so that is also kind of something to digest a little bit.
What was it like getting around the city in Amsterdam? What was
I biked everywhere?
Great.
I actually came home with enormous scars all over my legs
from falling.
Yeah, from
great
running into crashes. Yeah, but I lived outside of the city, so every morning I biked 10K into class, and because my class was in the middle of the city. But it was all flat, so I didn't even break a sweat. And then I biked 10K home. It was really easy. The infrastructure is just perfect. It's set up really well, so it's really safe and enjoyable.
What was the story that you were telling to people when you came back? I know how I was on exchange as well this year, and when I came back, there was, you kind of find a story that you're gonna tell to people just because it's easy and it's quick. Did you have one? Did you have another method for it?
Oh man, nothing is coming to mind. What's your story, Josh?
My story, I mean, it did change because eventually I just got so sick of telling the story. I had a couple that were going. There was definitely one about seeing Hans Ulrich Obrist at Serpentine, outside of the Serpentine Gallery at Hyde Park, and I was walking around, and there was this big group of kids on the lawn, maybe like my age, kind of cool art kids sitting, and I look over, and I think I see Hänselrik Obrist coming out of Serpentine Gallery. I'm like, this is wild. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been in London. I was in London maybe 2 weeks when I saw him. And so I went over to the kids who were all, they were all looking at him as well. And that was another thing that set me off. I was like, okay, this has got to be the real deal.
Like, checking him out.
Yeah, I'm not the only one checking him out. So I go over, and I was like, is that him? Is that Hänselrik Obrist? And they go, yeah, he's our boss. We all work at the Serpentine Gallery. And I just was so embarrassed that I was just this fanboy, and they were all just working with him on a day-to-day basis. But then the more I thought of it, the more I realized that it was also really kind of silly that they'd be so enamored with him, too. Because they were like his boss. Yeah. They were, you know, it wasn't even a big deal for them to see him, but they were still just so looking at this. And he's tall. He's a tall... Uh-huh. You know, I think he's Swiss or he has, you know, Central European, very tall and very imposing, very friendly guy. But they were just looking at him like all these heads were turned. Anyways, I put my tail between my legs and I left.
Oh, man.
The art, though, beautiful in Europe, yes. Isn't it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I was at the Stedelijk maybe 8 or 9 times while I was in Amsterdam.
That's great.
Yeah. I did think of a story.
Okay, okay.
It definitely relates to back home more than to my exchange itself, but my grandmother, my baba, this love of my life, she wrote me letters every week.
That's adorable.
Uh-huh. And my favorite letter was one she wrote me about taking the bus and like wanting to like text my little sister. So me and my little sister taught my baba how to text. She has a little flip phone and she knows how to use it. We've made her practice and she can send like I'll be home in 5 minutes little text. Takes her a while, but she knows how. So she sent me this letter telling me about how she got on the bus and saw a very hunky young man. So she sat down beside him and pulled out her little flip phone and said, like, excuse me, like, I need to text my granddaughter telling her that I'm on my way home, but I don't know how to send a text. Could you show me how? So my grandmother is like she knows how to pick up dudes. She's got some moves. And that made me so happy to get that letter.
And the text was sent.
The text was sent.
I can't wait till I'm old and get that kind of benefit of the doubt, too.
Oh, yeah.
Where everything just seems really charming. Uh-huh. That's great. Yeah. Elena, do you have any songs for us today?
I have been listening to a lot of War Paint.
Oh, great. After the show last week, 2 weeks ago?
Last week, I think. Best show I've seen all year, I think I can say.
Do you have a particular track that you're interested in hearing?
Love Is to Die is pretty good.
I'm going to pull that up for us right now. This is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM, and this is War Paint.
Listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Yo, this is Textbook, CITR 101.9. I'm here with Elena.
Hey.
And Evie.
Hi.
I was just talking with Elena about exchange and stories and the stories that we tell people. Sorry, just fixing the mic here. Evie is the inaugural participant in a segment that I like to call Tell Me About Your Paper. And it has to do with research and things that people are doing on campus and stuff they're doing in their academic life. And it's not meant to be too serious, but sometimes it is meant to be very serious. Because you work on this paper or you work on this research for like 3 weeks, maybe more, maybe a week. But it even if it's just a week, it's very intense. It's a very intense time. And nobody really gets to understand that. And nobody ever really feels how in-depth you get into it. And maybe one other person reads it. Maybe just the person that marks it reads it. But for you, it's like your entire world. So I wanted to kind of open that up as a discussion. Elena's hanging out. Elena's in English.
Yeah.
Evie's also in English. Evie's also in history?
Yes. Double major in English literature and history.
And what's your focus been?
So my focus for probably my whole undergrad degree has been on Asian Canadian history and how this history has been mediated throughout popular discourse, and especially in media as well. And so I am looking at the ways in which certain events have been really depicted in films, in movies, in photography. Yeah.
And you were doing some stuff over the summer.
Yeah, so
with the department, right?
Yeah, so I have to really thank Dr. Laura Ishiguro for for supporting me throughout my academic career, especially this summer. She got me some grant funding so I could do some research on how on some of the events that are really important, I think, to Asian Canadian history, especially locally here in Vancouver. So over the summer, I got the chance to write about some write on some Wikipedia pages, because I like looking at Wikipedia as a source of public history and how it really is our first point of interaction with different historical narratives on such a wide range as well. And so I wrote on some art exhibits that have happened in Vancouver. So there was Racy Sexy in 1993, there was Yellow Peril in 1990, and I found... I know about these exhibits from my volunteer hours at Center A, which is the Contemporary Asian Art Gallery in Chinatown. So if anyone has the time to go down there, I highly recommend it. Such a really inspiring place. Yeah.
How did you find the Wikipedia community?
The Wikipedia community was actually based on an essay that I read in my third year. I was taking a public history course with Dr. Tamara Myers. And her course was on public history and the ways in which we, again, interact with different historical narratives on a really wide scale. And so I read on this article about how this one professor, I think it was either in Western or some other university in Canada, and how she set up her students to be engaged in Wikipedia article writing because feminist issues, issues on race, gender, sexuality tend to be underrepresented on Wikipedia. And so in order to change that, it's luckily enough, Wikipedia advertises itself as a public domain sort of place or a place where a lot of people can interact with writing articles. And so her project that she set up for her class was to write more on Wikipedia and to be engaged in what kind of topics are on there. So again, we're looking at history that is primarily focused on Western history or dominated history on patriarchal subjects. And so in order to really take back the power and agency of historical practice, write more, be engaged in public discourse, and what other better way to do it than on Wikipedia?
Right. And have you found that the work that you're doing on Wikipedia has informed the kind of writing you're doing now this semester, like kind of after this, or is it ongoing?
It's still ongoing. So some of the articles that I've written over the summer are still there. Some of them have been taken down, unfortunately, because Wikipedia has deemed it illegitimate, which has been a little bit unfortunate. And some things still need to be worked on because, again, we're working with histories that haven't been really talked about. So we have, like, again, in popular Canadian historiography, we have certain events like the Royal Commission on Chinese Immigration. And these are the things that a lot of historians point towards when we talk about Asian Canadian history. But for me, and for a lot of people, it's not enough. And I don't want to discredit these events because they really are important. But my problem with that is that when we focus so much on these issues or what historians have deemed as key issues or key events, we're isolating these events from ongoing issues, things that have to do with racial and sexual discrimination and gender-based discrimination, where in fact there are a lot of people who are, and still today, tackling these issues.
And what kind of work have you been doing this semester? I mean, outside of this project, has there been other writing that...
It's been a little bit of like Wikipedia, as well as looking at how contemporary Asian artists have been tackling this ongoing dialogue with their histories. So again, like I've mentioned some of the exhibitions earlier, and these are really key events in Asian Canadian art, where a lot of people are talking about how they have been, how their lives and their histories have been mediated through Western media. And they're trying to reclaim that power and trying to reclaim their voice and agency. And these things are you know, historically compounded, and it's overwhelming. But the fact that these contemporary Asian artists are taking history in their own hands, it's really inspiring work, and I'm trying to do a little bit more research on that.
Is it focused in Vancouver mostly?
Mostly in Vancouver. So, yeah, so Racy Sexy was held in 93, and that was a really huge exhibition that happened in multiple places, and it was, and again, like, there were a lot of artists who were talking about their struggles with gender and sexuality and how their gender and sexuality has been dictated by our Western values or by Western binaries.
And then what about the other, there was another exhibition you had just mentioned.
Oh yeah, so Yellow Peril, that was in 1990, and that was curated by Paul Wong, who is like a really highly regarded artist in Canada. And some of the artist's works that he curated, some of these people, they're still practicing, and some of these people are actually like professors at OCAD, for example. Richard Fung, he is a professor at OCAD. And what's really interesting for me is that they're using media such as film and photography and trying to rework the ways in which we understand Asian history and Asian Canadian history. And they're trying to really change the visual vocabulary of these identities and these lives.
How have you found it changing your style for Wikipedia as well? I found when I was doing some digging into it and the style guide, the Wikipedia style guide,
yeah,
which is extensive.
It's extensive and it's tumultuous, and it makes me, like, honestly pissed off sometimes, just because I hate it when they tell me that this source is illegitimate or that what I'm looking at are unreal events or untrue events. And it's frustrating because how can we claim this history when, at first, it's underrepresented anyways? So, again, the main sources that I was working with were exhibition catalogs that I found at Center A and that I got to talk about with Tyler Russell and Natalie Tan from Center A. They showed me these exhibition catalogs, and they were like, these are really pivotal moments in Canadian art history and in Asian Canadian art history. Like, these are really important things that we have to remember. And so I use that as my main source when writing the Wikipedia articles. And it's been hard because I have editors on Wikipedia who know their thing on this domain, and they keep telling me, they're like, your sources are illegitimate. They're not, for us, they're like nothing. They're not real. And so it's difficult, you know?
And we're talking about things you're physically holding in your hand.
Yeah, things that...
Catalogs.
Not only that, but like these exhibitions were only held in like the 90s. Like there are still people living who actually went to this exhibit. Like, these are very real experiences. And to have it disregarded is so heavy, but you know what, that's the really big issue with historical practice anyways. Who has the agency to write it?
Right. One thing that really struck me when I came back to Vancouver in May, and I think it must have been while Mashup was going on, or while it was,
yeah,
maybe it just started, one thing that really struck me was just the immense reception that show had as kind of a form, like, it was just a public discussion. Everybody was talking about, mm-hmm, this exhibition. I thought that was great. And I was, it really was just like life in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
What was the reception like of these exhibitions?
These exhibitions were huge. Like, I don't want to discredit them at all because they were so important, especially with Racy Sexy, because some of the exhibition pieces or some of the performances or some of the visual material, they were showcased in different community centers around Vancouver, spaces that were meant for Indigenous communities as well. And we have this really great show of solidarity between different communities in Canada. The thing about, you know, Racy Sexy was that it wasn't exhibited at the Vancouver Art Gallery. They have their own agenda, and they have very specific artists that they want to show at the gallery. Whereas with other smaller nonprofit galleries, such as Centre A or 221A or Access, they are working with, like, I don't want to call them smaller name artists, but artists that the Vancouver Art Gallery don't want to support, it seems. I want to argue that these exhibits were mainly for the community, and mainly not just like on an international scale, but really for tackling subjects and histories that are local to us.
And how did you feel? I sense a little bit of qualms with the Vancouver Art Gallery and with Mashup especially. Am I wrong in saying that? If I'm going to cook up some dirt.
Oh my gosh. Hands down, I support the work at Centre A. They do such amazing work, and so do all the other art galleries around Vancouver, especially right now in Chinatown. We have a lot of art galleries that really serve a good purpose in their community. We see how Chinatown is changing every single day, and it's actually really scary to see. But the kind of work that Centre A does creates greater bonds between not just Asian Canadian artists, but artists working in Hong Kong or in Vietnam or in China and or in Korea. So the fact that we support these artists, not just locally, but internationally, it really creates stronger bonds, and especially how we communicate history through visual arts as well.
There is a sort of, it feels like there's a kind of renaissance in Chinatown right now, to use a kind of maybe sort of problematic term to describe that, but it does feel like there's a lot of energy there right now along that those galleries, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing to see.
Do you have a song for us?
I have.
Send us off.
I have "I Bet on Losing Dogs" by Mitski.
Great, thank you so much, Evie.
Thank you.
This is "I Bet on Losing Dogs" by Mitski on CITR 101.9 FM.
I know they're losing. This is Noah from Christ on Parade, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Where's Matt? You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
You are now tuned into the sounds of Disorder.
1, 2, 3, Android. Are you ready? Come on. Are you ready?
Hey, this is Wade.
And I'm Matt.
And this is Disorder Radio.
We're the on-air baby of Disorder Magazine, your Vancouver indie music monthly.
You're listening to Disorder Radio, CITR.
CITR.
CITR 101.9 FM.
Tune in every Tuesday for live interviews, music from the hottest local artists, and good times.